I'm not gonna like this, am I?
Bones asks grimly when Jim shows up in his quarters with two shot glasses at an hour when most crew members on their shift are already asleep. No, Jim replies, equally grimly. He digs the doctor's bottle of whiskey out from under the bed, pours Bones a shot, then hands it to him. Drink, Jim says. You're going to need it.
This night just gets better and better,
Bones mutters, but he drinks. Jim pours himself a matching shot and drinks it down with no formalities.
You gonna tell me what's going on now?
Bones asks, but Jim just shakes his head and pours each of them a second shot. You're gonna need this one too, he says, and the two shots go down smooth.
How many times are we going to do this little song and dance routine?
Bones asks, and Jim shakes his head. That's it. I mean, I think at some point in this conversation, we're both going to want some more, and by the end, Bones, I think your bottle is going to have passed into that beautiful afterlife where empty bottles of booze go when they've served their rightful purpose. But there's not really ever going to be a good time to tell you this, so I might as well get it over with now. I'm adopting Spock's kid. Bones stares at Jim until the captain starts to feel pretty uncomfortable.
The worst part,
says Bones, after a couple long minutes.
The hell of it. The absolute hellish thing about it is that I can tell you're completely serious. Tell me you're not serious.
I am.
Pass me that bottle.
After they each have one more shot, Bones gives Jim a long, considering look that Jim's not quite sure how to interpret, then says,
I almost can't believe I'm about to say this, but Jim, this is not the dumbest idea you've ever had.
Jim is shocked at how relieved that makes him feel. Thank you, he stammers out, overwhelmed and kind of embarrassed.
I mean,
Bones continues,
I could tell you all the millions of things that could go wrong, but something about the look on your face tells me you've already got all of them playing in front of you like an old-fashioned motion picture.
When Jim nods gratefully, Bones shrugs.
Thing is, you're probably no less qualified for this whole fatherhood business than I was when Joanna was born, and I did okay. I always thought so anyway. I think most people do okay, if they've got the temperament for it. And for all that, you're a self-destructive freak show of recklessness.
Tell me how you really feel, Bones, Jim mutters.
You are actually something resembling a responsible person. In the sense that you've been responsible for the ship and crew for 6 months, and the ship's still in one piece, and the crew's still mostly sane. Well, as sane as they were when they started, which isn't saying much.
Uncomfortable with real praise, the way he always is, Jim smiles it away and changes the subject. Well, I'll always be able to call on you for sage advice, isn't that right, Bones? He'd meant to make Bones groan and start some tirade about how he's a doctor, not a parenting counselor. But Jim can tell from the slow, careful way that Bones pours his next shot that, somehow, that hit close to home.
How old's the kid?
Is all Bones says. 10.
I haven't seen Joanna since she was 7, so don't know how much good I'll be. But you're welcome to ask anyway.
Jim stares at Bones, and Bones stares at the bottom of his shot glass, and the shot glass stares back. I didn't know, Jim wants to say, but he should have known. Would have, if he wasn't such a self-absorbed dumbfuck. What did he think it meant, when Bones had nothing better to do over school vacation than hang around with Jim in scuzzy bars? When did he think Bones was finding the time to see his little girl? In the end, Jim gives up on the apology he knows Bones doesn't want. You'll be my resident expert, he promises instead. Bones pours a shot into Jim's glass, and when Jim tries to demur, Bones just shakes his head ominously and says,
You're gonna want this. Last one, I promise, but you're going to want this one.
Jim drinks it, looking suspiciously at Bones, who seems to be working up his courage. What for, Jim can't guess. Eventually, Bones steels himself visibly and says,
"Speaking of incredibly painful topics that neither of us want to touch, I know this might be extra tough for you because of what you told me back when."
Oh, fuck no. 4 shots are not enough for this shit. Bones should have just given him the bottle. "I thought we weren't talking about that for 2 years, says Jim. Bones looks some weird combination of pissed and guilty.
"We aren't. I mean, we didn't. I just... Oh, hell. Look, Jim, if you want to talk about it..."
Jim smiles, and it feels the same as when he smiles with a split lip, with a black eye, raw and ugly. Bones, trust me when I tell you that there is nothing in this entire galaxy that I want less than to talk about it. Really.
"Well, bite my head off, why don't you?"
Bones grumbles.
"And if you change your mind, I've got bourbon and a good listening ear."
"I'll give you that one," Jim allows.
"It's not like you can talk about it with that green-blooded bastard."
"Bones, that's enough," Jim says sharply. And he means it.
"Sorry,"
Bones says gruffly. They sit for a moment, awkwardly avoiding each other's eyes, and Jim thinks to himself that one of the great things about having Bones for a best friend, and that's what he is, Spock is something else, is knowing that Bones is wishing just as desperately as Jim is for some way to lighten the mood, some way to bring things back to room temperature. As usual for Bones, the strategy he picks is to grab the bottle and pour himself another shot. He motions as if to pour one for Jim, but Jim waves him off, and Bones raises an eyebrow. Jim mutters something that includes the words responsible and example and possibly role model, which makes Bones snort.
"So,"
Bones drawls, a disturbing twinkle in his eye,
"you're going to be Spock's wife, is what you're telling me."
Jim holds up his hands, alarmed. On the one hand, he appreciates that Bones is trying to lighten the mood, but on the other hand, just no. Hell no. No, no, no. Co-parent, or, you know, why do we have to label things anyway? That's such a destructive impulse, don't you think?
"No, no,"
Bones says, shaking his head, clearly enjoying the hell out of himself.
"You're definitely his wife. You know, I'm technically still empowered to officiate at weddings after that mission on Caratha with the..."
Jim points a finger at him threateningly, narrowing his eyes. "Bones, if I hear a single member of this crew refer to me as Spock's wife, I will know exactly who's responsible, and I will stab you in the face with one of your own hyposprays. I swear I will," Jim vows. But they're both laughing too hard for Bones to take him seriously. And that's all right. Bones is pretending to scribble something on his pad, muttering about correcting Jim's out-of-date marital status. Jim rolls his eyes. "You live to do this shit to me, don't you?" he asks. And Bones throws him an incredulous look.
"I do this shit to you? I put a phaser to your head and forced you to sign up to raise a 10-year-old Vulcan 6 months after you become the youngest and craziest captain in Starfleet history?"
"Yes," Jim hazards, unwilling to take the blame. But when Bones glares at him and pours himself yet another shot, Jim admits, "I do it to myself. But that doesn't mean you have to give me shit for it."
"Yes, it does,"
Bones replies, in a tone of voice that says that he thinks Jim is the biggest idiot he's ever met. No contest. Jim knows that's not true. Ensign Varma was in sickbay 3 days ago after successfully shooting herself in the ass with her own phaser. But Bones has been using that tone of voice on him for 3 years now. And after all this time, he kind of enjoys it.
"I'm your friend, Jim. God help us both,"
says Bones, as if to a small, not very bright child.
"That means I absolutely have to give you shit for it. That's pretty much the goddamn definition."
Jim thinks about that, and admits that, for the two of them, that's probably true. Of course, that means it's also Jim's solemn duty to give Bones shit for the dumb things that he does, but tonight, He just wants to enjoy the calm before the storm with somebody who's always had his back. And that's just what he's going to do. No, Bones, Jim says, shaking his head slowly in mock disappointment. I can see where you're coming from, but you've got it all wrong. You want to know the real definition of a best friend? Bones rolls his eyes tolerantly and says,
Hit me, kid.
Jim slouches down in his chair and raises his hands as if explaining the mysteries of the universe. A best friend, Bones, is somebody who will sit up with you in your cramped and ugly quarters for as long as it takes you to finish that bottle or pass out, whichever comes first. Then wrestle you into your bed and out of your boots, and then, out of love and understanding, not make you listen to loud noises or look at bright lights in the morning. Bones considers this.
You could be onto something there,
he concedes. Jim smiles a winner's smile. I usually am, he says, and sticks around until his duties as a best friend have been fully discharged.
Spock stares at the blank vid screen in his quarters. Logically, he knows that continuing to postpone this conversation will not make it any easier, nor is his anxiety in any way productive. He inputs the necessary sequence and runs his tongue over his lips to moisten them. When the older Vulcan's face appears on the screen, Spock inclines his head and says, Father?
Spock.
The two of them regard each other in silence for several long moments. For more than 8 years, from the time of Spock's departure for Starfleet to the time of Vulcan's destruction, Spock had not spoken to his father. They have attempted to communicate more regularly in the past 6 months, but they are out of practice with each other. I received a communication from T'Pau 3 days ago, Spock says.
Regarding T'Pring's son.
Sarek says, as expressionless as ever. Spock suppresses a wave of irritation. You knew of this child's existence? He asks.
Certainly not, Spock.
Sarek reproves him.
I learned of him only when the matter came before the Council. Only hours before T'Pau contacted you. Is it true that you have decided to claim him as your own?
Indeed, Father.
You know that it is impossible that he is your son.
Sarek says, and Spock inclines his head. Indeed, I also know how cruel Vulcan children can be to those whom they perceive to be different or outcast.
Then your decision is most praiseworthy.
Spock conceals his start of surprise. He had not expected that his father would approve of his decision to claim T'Pring's son. It was, Spock is forced to admit, a decision of compassion rather than logic. The logical course of action, and the truthful one, would have been to deny paternity, to refuse to allow T'Pring's illogical and immoral behavior to upend Spock's own life, rupturing his romantic relationship with Lieutenant Uhura, and forcing Spock into a most unorthodox and somewhat uncomfortable new alliance with Captain Kirk. To hear his father praise his deceitful and illogical conclusion is utterly unexpected, but Spock cannot deny that it pleases him. Thank you, Father, he says simply.
I assume you will be returning to New Vulcan soon?
Says Sarek.
I look forward to welcoming you and your son. The colony will benefit greatly from your contributions.
I will not be leaving the Enterprise, Father, Spock says, narrowing his eyes slightly. Arrangements have been made for Storek's care and education on board. I will, of course, visit New Vulcan when the Enterprise's schedule permits, but I see no logical reason to abandon my commitments to Starfleet when there exists a way to fulfill my obligations both to the Enterprise and to the child.
A Vulcan should be raised among Vulcans, Spock. It is only logical that an environment of rationality, intellectual aspiration, and emotional control is best suited to producing an adult well-versed in those qualities.
Spock considers this argument. It is true that being raised on Vulcan, among Vulcans, has given Spock a keen grasp and appreciation of logic, and has supplied him with an emotional control without which he would be incapable of contributing constructively to his community. His work and upbringing has gifted him with a unique perspective that allows him to support the Federation in general, and the Enterprise in particular. By providing a complementary balance to the instinct and intuition of the captain and other humans. It is also true that being raised on Vulcan, among Vulcans, had left Spock utterly, at times embarrassingly, unprepared for the diverse and chaotic world that he had encountered within Starfleet. It was clearly an inadequate education for a citizen of the larger galaxy. It had also, illogically, sought to blind him to the role of emotion in many positive processes. Cementing interpersonal relationships, making moral decisions with limited time for reflection, and maintaining psychological health and balance under stressful circumstances. Spock's Vulcan education had instilled in him an unnecessary and, at times, destructive attitude of shame towards his own emotions and contempt towards the emotions of others, which was only partially mitigated by the influence of his human mother. I confess myself somewhat ambivalent about the long-term results of my own Vulcan upbringing and education, Father, Spock says evenly. While I do not regret the training I received, and while I would never imply that it was less than excellent, I also believe it to have been somewhat incomplete. I am confident in the ability of the Enterprise to supply a learning environment that, while different in its outward aspect from a Vulcan school, will still supply a rigorous education based on Surek's precepts. I would, of course, welcome any insight that you may have to offer into the process of constructing such a curriculum and defer to your greater experience. Sarek regards Spock in silence. As the seconds pass without interruption, Spock feels his previous anxiety return. Finally, Sarek speaks.
You do not detect any irony, Spock, in the fact that you are informing me that you welcome my insight and defer to my experience, while you are, in fact, in the very act of ignoring my recommendation and refuting my conclusion.
Spock is stricken. His father has not spoken so harshly to him since Mother died. Yet, Spock looks closer. Unlikely as it seems, there is something not unlike a glint of humor in his father's eyes.
You have always had your own way of doing things, Spock.
Sarek says, and his tone holds no condemnation.
I wanted you to become the ideal Vulcan by joining the Vulcan Science Academy. Instead, you made an unmatchable contribution to the Vulcan people by joining Starfleet. For nearly a decade, I believed that you had chosen to live outside of my values and rejected you. Instead, you spent that decade pursuing and embodying those values in a way I could never have predicted. I attempted to persuade you, to purge all emotion in order that you might be strong. Instead, those very emotions gave you the strength to avenge your mother and your people. It is only logical that, in the face of such overwhelming evidence, I accept that you, my son, may often exceed my hopes and expectations best when you act most in opposition to my wishes. I trust that a similar phenomenon may manifest itself in the case of your raising of young Starek.
Spock can think of no previous experience by which he may judge this utterly unexpected statement. Leaving aside the portion of his discomfort that arises from the uncomfortable comparison between himself and Captain Kirk that his father's words cannot help but evoke, it is only in the transporter room of the Enterprise, 6 months previous, that Sarek had first indicated that he might not utterly disapprove of the majority of Spock's choices. To hear so firm an approbation so suddenly is extremely surprising. Speaking from an illogical and sudden feelings of closeness with his father, Spock returns Sarek's confession with one of his own. I spoke in error in my previous statements. I told you that I am confident in my ability to raise Starek aboard the Enterprise, but truthfully, I fear that I may be unequal to the task. I had, in fact, planned to resign my Starfleet commission in order to better discharge my parental duties, but one of my fellow officers stepped in and volunteered to aid me. I admit that I am far from confident in my ability to fulfill all of the necessary roles that a parent must. I was sincere when I requested your advice. Sarek nods solemnly.
I am gratified by your trust in me, Spock. I vow to supply you with my advice whenever you request it. And, moreover, I vow to keep any displeasure to myself, should you choose to ignore my advice when it is given.
The 6 months since the death of Spock's mother have been turbulent, personally and professionally. There has been much that Spock must do, both in his capacity as first officer of the Enterprise, and in his capacity as a grieving son, and a grieving child of Vulcan. It is perhaps, then, excusable that Spock has not spent much of those 6 months since his father's extraordinary revelation, reflecting upon the new knowledge of his father that he gained that day. He has not, before this moment, truly considered what sort of man, what sort of Vulcan, his father must have been, to have fallen in love with a human woman and married her, in defiance of his family, his culture, and his entire world, to have chosen a career of diplomacy, pursuing the unfamiliarity and illogic of other stars and other peoples, rather than remaining safe within Vulcan's cocoon of logic, to have raised a half-human son without apology, without ever once expecting less of that son than any full Vulcan child. I am very grateful, Spock says, meaning every word. I will endeavor to give you no cause to feel any such displeasure.
Do not trouble yourself with it unduly,
Sarek says calmly.
All Vulcans, at some point in our lives, feel displeasure. And, to my knowledge, it has not been proven to have caused irreparable harm to any.
Spock can feel his eyes widen. I must assume that my father is utterly in earnest, Spock resolves. The alternative is too startling for me to accept with equanimity. Vulcans, as I have frequently explained to many of my fellow Starfleet officers, do not joke. Storik will arrive in 4 days, Father, says Spock, attempting to set aside his father's previous statement. If there is any advice that you can offer that may prepare me for our first meeting, I request that you share it.
Without having met the boy personally, it is difficult for me to advise you in this. As you are well aware, all Vulcans, including children, have their own distinct personalities. Additionally, I do not know how T'Pring raised him, or even whether he believes you to be his father in truth.
Sarek says, looking somewhat troubled.
All that I can offer is this general warning. These past 6 months have witnessed many changes in the Vulcan race. None of us can deny the existence of our emotions any longer. The web of grief ensnares us all, and it has broken some of the weaker minds among us. Do not expect young Storik to be analogous to the Vulcan children you remember from your own youth. Even the children have been changed by this tragedy, and I cannot tell you what you will find in the young one's mind. My advice is to meet the child with as few preconceptions as you can.
Spock thinks of a human aphorism, expect the unexpected, that has always seemed to him perfectly inane until this moment, a logical impossibility that has now become a moral necessity. Thank you for your advice, Spock says to his father, grave. I will follow it. I will keep you appraised of my progress in parenting and consult you frequently on the subject, if you are amenable.
Please do so.
Spock begins to say farewell, but Sarek forestalls him, saying,
If I may ask a personal query.
Somewhat nonplussed, it seems illogical to ask permission now, at the end of what has already been a deeply personal discussion. Spock assents.
You had mentioned, Spock, that one of your fellow officers would be joining you in raising Storik. May I inquire?
It is Captain Kirk, Father, Spock says quickly.
I see.
If Spock did not, beyond the shadow of a doubt, know better, he would suspect his father of laughing at him silently.
Live long and prosper, Spock,
Sarek intones, and Spock returns the gesture, then turns off the vid screen. Expect the unexpected. Spock cannot contain a frisson of unease. No doubt the captain will be delighted. There appears to be little that he enjoys more than the unexpected.
The day before the kid, Storik, Jim reminds himself, Storik, is set to arrive. Jim walks into the weekly bridge staff meeting and says, So, for those of you who've been living under a rock, or are too virtuous to listen to gossip, yes, it's true. Chekhov raises his hand. Jim rolls his eyes. I've told you that you don't have to do that, Chekhov.
That's nice, Captain.
Chekhov says politely, ignoring him totally.
What do you mean? Yes, it is true. What is true?
When Jim gives him a narrow-eyed look, Chekhov smiles innocently and says,
I must be too virtuous to gossip.
Uh-huh, says Jim, not believing a damn word of it. One of his hand-to-hand combat students had called him Mrs. Spock behind his back yesterday, and he knows that the day before, Bones had lunch with Chekhov and Sulu, and money changed hands. Bastards, Jim thinks bitterly.
I believe that the captain is referring to the persistent rumors that he and I will be entering into a joint parental relationship with the Vulcan boy Storik, who will be arriving on the Enterprise tomorrow.
Spock says, unruffled as usual.
You mean your son, yes?
Scotty asks.
Yes.
Spock replies, after a brief hesitation. He and Jim have agreed to keep most of the stuff about Storik's mother private. Uhura already knows, and Bones has to know for medical reasons, but Jim doesn't think either of them will talk. That's going to change a couple things, but not too much, Jim announces, and Spock picks up his cue smoothly.
The captain and I are usually scheduled on the bridge for the same shifts. While we will continue this practice in principle, we will be staggering our shifts slightly. For Alpha Shift, Captain Kirk will arrive for his shift an hour early.
Jim winces at the thought of his new wake-up time.
And will be leaving his shift an hour early. For Beta Shift, I will do the same.
Hopefully, most of you won't even notice the difference, Jim says. The bigger change is going to be on away missions. Except in cases where it is absolutely vital to the success of the mission, Commander Spock and I will not be going on away missions together. Ever. One of us will stay here with the ship and with Storik.
A policy,
Spock interjects.
That is standard on all other starships, and since it is the most logical option, perhaps ought to have been implemented on the Enterprise immediately.
Thank you, Mr. Spock, says Jim, glaring. Your opinion has been noted at great length. Sulu is laughing at them, the jerk. If anyone has any questions or comments about our new Vulcan passenger, speak now or forever hold your peace. Are you and Spock getting married? Sulu asks, grinning in a totally insubordinate way.
Which one of you is the mother?
Chekhov asks. Unlike Sulu, he's trying to keep a straight face, but like Sulu, he's just unwittingly signed up for at least 10 shifts of mandatory engineering inventory and safety compliance checks. Jim wants to make a joke about marooning them in the neutral zone, but looking over at Spock, he decides it's probably a little too soon.
Shut the hell up,
Bones mutters at Chekhov and Sulu, which Jim thinks is pretty rich, considering he started half those rumors. Until he sees the worried look Bones is giving Spock. Spock already has a wife, Jim remembers. And Storik already has a mother. And she's gone. He can see the thought sink into various faces around the table, just as clearly as he can see that Chekhov and Sulu didn't mean anything by it. He moves the meeting on to other topics as quickly as possible. On his way out of the meeting, Chekhov pulls him aside.
I am oldest of 10 cousins, yes? I miss it sometimes,
he says. And at first, Jim has no idea what brought on this spontaneous moment of sharing, but Chekhov continues.
I am oldest of 10 cousins, and the others are, like me, yes? Smart. And their parents are busy, so I help out. I am good at it, I think.
Jim thinks about this for a minute. Are you offering to babysit? Chekhov nods vigorously and says,
Also, from what I know, Vulcan education is very much ahead of ours. So if young one, his name is...
Storik, Jim supplies.
Storik, yes. If he wants to keep learning physics at the level he is used to, I think maybe you will need me, or Mr. Scott, of course.
Jim blinks. You're offering to babysit and be a physics teacher?
Yes.
Chekhov shrugs and gives Jim a small smile.
Like I said, I miss it sometimes. And it is good for you and Mr. Spock to do this thing, yes? And we want to help, and I am sorry for Joke.
He adds quietly, looking at his feet. Well, Jim stalls, pretty surprised, but also pretty damn grateful. Well, thanks, Chekhov. We'll take you up on it. He decides that Chekhov maybe doesn't need to do 10 shifts of inventory after all. Before the end of his shift that day, Jim is buttonholed by at least half a dozen other crew members, including Sulu, Scotty, Nurse Chapel, Ensign Varma of the unfortunate phaser incident, and even Gala, all volunteering to take Storik off his hands for a few hours when they're needed, or to teach their subject specialty. It's one of those moments when he's incredibly grateful to be the captain of the Enterprise, not because it's a starship, but because it's this starship, crewed by these people. He already knew, when he set out on this 5-year mission, that he had an unbeatable team that could pull together in a crisis and give more than anyone could ask in the performance of their duties. What he didn't know, Jim muses, feeling a little like he's been hit over the head with a blunt instrument, is that apparently the definition of crisis is a little wider than he thought. The stunned gratitude lasts long enough that Jim doesn't remember to start panicking until about 12 hours before Storik is set to arrive. It's the ship's weird equivalent of night, and he can't even think about sleeping, and he doubts Spock is anywhere close to sleeping either. Without knowing why, he heads for the observation deck, which is thankfully empty. Ignoring the star's slow passage around him, Jim sinks onto one of the hard benches and lowers his head into his hands, feeling the weight of this new responsibility pushing down on him. It makes him think of one of his first exercises at the Academy, navigating a simulation of a malfunctioning shuttle, attempting to safely land it and keep the other passengers calm, while the internal gravity regulators, deteriorating, pressed down and down on him until he had to crawl his way over to the pilot's controls. He'd done it, of course, and he'll fucking well do this too if it kills him. But that doesn't mean he likes the way it feels right now. What was he thinking, signing up to raise a kid? I know what I was thinking, Jim reminds himself. I was thinking that I can't do this without Spock. I was thinking that this kid is in a tough place, and maybe I can help. I was thinking that maybe even an irresponsible fuck-up with authority issues is still a better parent than no parent at all.
You appear troubled, Captain.
Jesus, Spock! Jim looks up at Spock, who had somehow snuck up on him while Jim was too busy feeling sorry for himself to notice. Warn a guy, would you? He grumbles, but scoots over on the bench and pats the empty spot next to him. Spock takes the seat without protest and looks over at Jim. Troubled, Jim says, slowly. Yeah, I guess you could say that. Me, I'd go with shitting my pants from gut-wrenching fear. But that's not really something a Vulcan would say, is it? Of course, you're probably totally zen about this whole thing, aren't you? Jim concludes glumly. But when he looks over at Spock, he can see the tension strung through the Vulcan's shoulders and neck.
It is possible that you may not be alone in your trepidation,
Spock admits.
May I ask the source of your distress?
Jim thinks about how honest he wants to be and settles on almost completely. I don't know if I can do this, he confesses to Spock, who shows no reaction. I mean, the only really good parental role model I ever had growing up died about 30 seconds after I was born. So I'm flying blind here, Spock. I think the basics are pretty clear. Don't hit the kid. Don't let him eat candy for every meal. Make sure he brushes his teeth and washes his face. Give him some kind of decent education. And don't let him get any broken bones, stitches, fatal diseases, tattoos, piercings, or ugly haircuts. Other than that, I've got nothing, Spock. I probably should have told you before. If you change your mind about this craziness now, I won't blame you. Jim's still watching Spock closely, but there's no reaction on his first officer's face. So I said that, and I meant it, Jim thinks, as the silence stretches out. But if he backs out now, after all the freaking out I've had to do, I will kill him.
I have observed, Captain,
Spock finally says, carefully,
that it is often in situations where you are flying blind, as you put it, that your talents come most to the fore. In the areas of improvisation and innovation, your strengths are unmatched. I see no reason why the current situation should be an exception.
Jim is forced to acknowledge that he's feeling pretty damn warm and cuddly about Spock after that little speech. Not that he's going to let on. So think of the kid as a Klingon warbird and I'll be fine, is what you're saying, Jim says, enjoying the way that Spock can't help twitching a little with irritation. As often happens, Spock decides not to dignify Jim's wisecrack with a response. Instead, he looks up above their heads at the stars drifting by.
Your guidelines for proper parenting, while unorthodox, seem largely accurate,
Spock says, and Jim thinks, guidelines for parenting? Before remembering, no candy, no stitches, etc.
I am pleased to find that we share similar values,
Spock continues.
If it is amenable to you, I would like to make one guideline of my own, based on my own experience as a child.
Jim nods quickly. He's your son, Spock. I'm not going to argue with you about how to raise him.
He is T'Pring's son,
Spock corrects him. There's definitely some strong emotion behind that statement, but Jim can't figure out exactly what it is, and that makes him nervous. If you don't want to do this, he starts, but that's not quite right. If you're angry at the kid, then that's a problem, Jim tries again, and knows that that's a massive understatement. But Spock shakes his head swiftly.
No, I could not be. I am not. But I will admit to some confusion and disapproval towards T'Pring's actions.
Spock stands, and Jim's left side immediately feels colder. Spock doesn't pace. Vulcans don't, Jim knows. But the fact that he moved at all is a sign that he's pretty agitated.
Through her dishonesty and illogical behavior, she has made both my life and the child's life much more difficult. Logically, I know that she must have had some reason for her actions. But now that she is dead, I do not expect that I will ever learn of it. It is an unsolvable puzzle,
Spock finishes, looking the slightest bit lost. There's a lot Jim could say here, but he keeps his mouth shut.
She may have been in love. She may merely have been lonely. It is even possible that she consciously intended to spite me. I do not know why she did not terminate our betrothal and marry Storik's father. I do not know if Storik's father survived the destruction of Vulcan.
Jim can see that Spock takes each statement as a mark of some kind of personal failure, which is crazy, but in a very Spock kind of way. I'm sorry, he says, and the corners of Spock's mouth twitch downward.
You are not responsible for this,
Spock replies. I'm sorry anyway. There's quiet for a minute, and then Jim remembers. Did you say there was some kind of a rule you wanted to make? Spock nods and returns to his place on the bench next to Jim.
That is correct. If it is amenable to you, I would like to institute a policy of honesty. I understand that this is atypical of standard human child-rearing customs, which often endorse frequent lies, especially of omission, but...
Jim's ready to say that's fine with him, but from the way Spock trailed off, he can tell that he has more to say.
When I was Storik's age,
Spock says, after a short silence,
my father told me that he had married my human mother because it was logical. Only later, when she was lost to both of us, did he admit to me that he had married her because he loved her. I understand the cultural pressures that prompted his deception. Nevertheless, it was. I would greatly have preferred to know the truth. I will not attempt to deceive Storik in such a way, or in any way.
Absolute honesty, huh? Jim asks, and Spock nods. Even with each other? Spock considers this, then nods once more.
I find it difficult to conceive of any viable alternative.
Jim knows what he has to do. He doesn't like it, but he's done it before, and it didn't kill him then. He reaches for Spock's hand, slowly, giving Spock plenty of time to see it coming, then slowly brings that hand up to the side of his own face. "Do it," he says quietly. Spock looks the Vulcan version of flustered, and he tries to take his hand back.
"Captain, Jim, this is not what I meant."
"I know, but it's... you want absolute honesty, right?"
"You do not know what you are offering."
"I've done it before, with the older you," Jim says, and he can see Spock's surprise. "So, yeah, I know." Spock considers this, and then nods slowly.
"If you are willing, then I see no logical objection."
He returns his hand to Jim's face, and his fingers are firm and certain.
"My mind to your mind,"
Spock whispers, and Jim just has time to think, "Huh, that's different," before the observation deck falls away, and he's... landing a surprisingly solid punch on the bully's face, feeling his knuckles split, and absently noting the green blood welling to the surface. "Good for you, kid Spock," Jim thinks. And then he's... refusing his mother's embrace for the first time, willing her to understand, even as he can see the sadness on her opened human face. And he's... turning his back on the council as he leaves the chamber, nauseous, his Vulcan half thinking, "What have I done?" And his human half so fiercely glad he can almost taste it on his tongue, like sharply cold water. And Jim hears a flash of the phrase,
"Emotional need to rebel."
And can't help thinking, "I think they mistook you for me there, Spock." And he's sending another message to his father, knowing that it will be ignored, like the previous 24, knowing that his illogical persistence in attempting to communicate can, at this point, only reinforce his father's opinion of his unacceptable failure of logic. And he's sitting in the academy cafeteria at lunch, alone even though there are few empty seats. This will be his 467th meal alone, and it does not make him feel lonely or resentful, because he is a Vulcan, and therefore it does not make him feel anything at all. And he's sitting in the academy cafeteria at lunch, alone again, and someone puts their tray on the table across from him and asks, "Commander Spock, may I sit with you?" And it's Cadet Uhura, and she is smiling at him with no pity, only interest in something he cannot name. "I can name it for you," Jim thinks, and he discovers he can smirk mentally, which is pretty awesome. And he's plucking the strings of his Ka Athera, and she asks if he would mind if she sang with him, and it is only logical that he agree, and she sings a lullaby, and he finds it not soothing at all to his chagrin, and Jim crows, "I knew it!" And he's forced to admit that he does not know how this particular cadet has beaten his unbeatable test, and he is extremely displeased, because he does not like not knowing things. He does not like it at all, and he's losing her, losing her, losing her, and he's... Spock's mind was a surprisingly comfortable place to be, warm and ordered and strongly alive. Jim can tell right away when Spock's redirected them into Jim's own mind, and he's not sure he likes what he sees. The loud, bright chaos and the dark corners where things are missing or damaged or badly patched back together, and he's just sitting in a diner with his mom, minding his own business, and the waitress is telling him how his daddy was a hero, and Jim just kind of wants to eat his pancakes, but his mom doesn't look so good, and he doesn't know what to do. And he's waving goodbye at his mom and thinking about that diner and all the other ways that she kept being reminded. And he's not crying, because it's good. She shouldn't have to stay here and be reminded all the time. And if she sees him cry, then maybe she'll stay, which Jim selfishly wants, but he understands. And he's anywhere, anywhere but here. He's building a starship in his head, and that's where his head's going to go when this happens again, because Jim's given up on thinking that it's not going to happen again and again and again, and he needs something else to think about besides the hand... There's a loud thud, and when Jim looks around, the meld is broken, and he and Spock are both on the floor. He must have pushed Spock, which he feels guilty about, but... "I'm sorry, man," Jim gasps, still breathing hard. "But there's honesty, and then there's... that. There are places in my head where... no. Just no. I'm sorry, but... I can't." Spock looks pretty shaken, too, and he shakes his head slowly.
"Please do not apologize. Our minds connected very easily. So easily that it did not occur to me that you would not have sufficient experience to learn selective shielding. In the future, if there are memories that you wish to conceal, you may imagine draping a dark cloth over them, or closing a door in front of them, or employ another suitable metaphor of concealment."
Jim laughs, and winces when he hears how fake it sounds. "Don't worry about it, Spock," he says, as he gets up from the floor, offering Spock his hand to help him do the same. "I said I knew what I was doing. Obviously, I was full of it."
"On the contrary, I have known you long enough that I should not have taken your unquestioning high assessment of your own expertise on faith,"
Spock replies, dry as a desert, and Jim considers being insulted, but just laughs again instead. "Did you find what you were looking for when you were strolling around in my brain?" he asks Spock idly. He knows enough about Vulcan telepathy to know that the brief concrete flashes he saw were the least of it. Spock's mind would have been processing thoughts and memories 10 times that fast, and with 10 times as much depth, nuance, and immediacy. Spock catches his gaze and holds it as he says,
"I found nothing in your mind to cast doubt upon the opinions of your character and integrity that I had already formed."
Jim figures that's probably a good thing. "Yeah, you too," he replies. We'll be okay at this. We have to be."
"You are referring to the child, Storek. I concur. I believe that our strengths and abilities are complementary, and this as in command of the Enterprise."
"Is there anything in particular I should know?" Jim asks. He's been doing some reading up on Vulcans and their maturation process, but Spock's first-hand knowledge will do him a lot more good than something from a Starfleet medical text.
"There is something that my father told me,"
Spock says.
"A piece of advice that I believe to be very much suited to your personality."
"Your father? Suited to me?" Jim raises a dubious eyebrow to rival Spock's best. "Not that I know a whole lot about your dad, but those seem like pretty strange phrases to put in the same sentence."
"I too was surprised,"
Spock admits.
"But his advice, paraphrased, was simply this. Expect the unexpected."
Jim's eyes widen, and he gives Spock kind of an uncertain grin. That must be one hell of a paraphrase. But, on the other hand, that does sound right up his alley. "I can do that," he says, and Spock inclines his head gracefully.
"I had no doubt. I will try to do the same. To be prepared for whatever we might encounter. The readiness is all,"
Spock quotes, and Jim says, "Shakespeare," automatically, enjoying the surprise in the line of Spock's eyebrows. "You know," he says, smirking, "someday you're finally going to realize that I'm an educated, intelligent, well-read guy, and then I'm going to have to get a new hobby."
"I sincerely doubt that."
"You doubt that I'm an educated guy?"
"I doubt that my hypothetical acceptance of that extremely dubious concept, or any other force in the known universe, will succeed in dissuading you from your current hobby of attempting to elicit an emotional response from me."
Jim starts to laugh, but his brain snags on that phrase, "attempt to elicit an emotional response." When he remembers why, remembers what came before that punch, he winces. "Hey, you know that..." Spock raises a hand to hold him off.
"Jim, you are my friend. I would not..."
Spock trails off and looks infinitely put upon. Jim's noticed that Spock only gets that look around him, which makes him grin when Spock's not looking.
"I would not continue to permit your frequent provocations. If I did not find them...
Jim can see Spock searching for an adjective.
On occasion, diverting.
Spock finishes, and Jim translates that as, I'm too uptight to admit it, but if we ever stopped pulling each other's pigtails, I'd cry. Yeah, me too, he replies, smiling.
Indeed.
Spock says, looking uncomfortable.
Storik is scheduled to arrive at 1200 hours tomorrow. It would be logical to rest as much as possible, in order that we may discharge our duties adequately before we greet him.
Jim snorts. Are you going to get any sleep tonight? He asks. And Spock looks as shifty as a Vulcan can look, which is, surprisingly, pretty damn shifty.
Vulcans do not require as much sleep as...
Spock trails off as Jim smirks. That's a no, then.
That is correct.
Then stay with me. If neither one of us is going to get any sleep, it would be illogical to just sit and brood in our quarters alone, am I right?
Vulcans do not brood,
Spock says severely, then relents.
That said, your proposal is not without merit. Do you desire conversation?
Jim gives that some thought, then shrugs. Not really. Just company. He and Spock sit side by side on the bench, and no one comes to bother them, and Jim thinks about tomorrow and puts some manly effort into not freaking out. Eventually, he gets distracted from his own head by the stars floating past, sometimes one by one in dark stretches of empty space, sometimes in blazing white clusters. And eventually, even though he could have sworn it wasn't possible, he sleeps.
At 1200 hours, the Enterprise slows to a sufficient speed to allow the civilian transport shuttle to dock. Spock is waiting in the shuttle bay with Captain Kirk. They had agreed that it would be unwise to overwhelm the boy with an excess of new people. When Storik emerges from the shuttle, Spock feels a sharp jab at his side. And when he looks to his right, the captain hisses,
Are you really 100% absolutely sure this kid's not yours?
Spock can understand what prompted Captain Kirk to such a question. The younger Vulcan walking towards them bears a very strong resemblance to Spock's younger self. His skin is quite pale, and his eyes and hair are dark. His bone structure also closely resembles Spock's own. However, as Spock points out to Kirk in a low voice, most Vulcans look superficially alike, and the boy's mother, T'Pring, was also dark of hair and eye. The boy comes to a stop in front of him and sets down his small suitcase.
I am Storik, son of T'Pring. I assume that you are Spock, son of Sarek.
Fascinating, Spock thinks. Already he has learned something about the young Vulcan. Namely, that he is not ashamed to identify himself with a matronym, despite the fact that it clearly announces his illegitimate status to anyone with even a minimal familiarity with Vulcan culture. Of course, the subtlety has doubtless escaped Kirk. Spock makes a note to explain the implications to the captain at a later time. I am Spock, he replies, and this is the captain of the Enterprise, James T. Kirk. We will be assuming joint parental responsibility for you.
It's good to meet you, Storik,
Kirk says, and Spock is pleased to note that the captain attempts no physical overtures, such as a handshake or an embrace.
Spock and I were thinking that we would take you to your new quarters, get you settled in. And then later, I'd show you around the ship. Is that acceptable?
Storik nods gravely. He is of average height for a Vulcan of 10 years of age, and does not appear to be malnourished, or in any way poorly treated. Spock is pleased to note. He follows the two of them silently to the turbolift, and then to Spock's new quarters. These are our shared quarters, Spock says, as Storik looks around with no obvious curiosity. This is our common room. Adjoining it on the left is my room, and adjoining it to the right is yours. Our two individual rooms also adjoin one another.
And I'm right next door,
Kirk adds, jerking a thumb at the wall which separates his quarters from Spock's.
So if you need anything and Spock's not around, you can always call me on the comm or come knock on my door. I have to get back to the bridge now, but I'll be back later to give you a tour of the Enterprise, okay?
Spock is troubled to note, as Kirk walks out the door, that he views the captain's departure with some small trepidation. Contrary to his declarations last night, Kirk seems to be very much at ease in Storek's presence, and Spock feels illogically abandoned by his necessary absence. "I grieve with thee," Spock says, into the sudden silence, uttering the traditional words of solace. Storek looks up at him calmly and asks,
"Do you?"
"What do you mean?" Spock asks, thrown.
"The impression I always received from my mother, when she spoke of you, was that you did not find her to be congenial company, that you disliked her, if it is not inappropriate to use such a term."
"That is correct," Spock admits, "but I admired her. She was very strong, and I find that I miss her presence in my mind. I regret her death very much."
"I believe it is reasonable to assume that you had no knowledge of my existence prior to the Vulcan Council's communication,"
Storek says, in a tone of voice that indicates that it is a question rather than a statement, while Spock once again struggles to regain his equilibrium.
"I know that you're not my father,"
the boy says casually, at once both accurately diagnosing the source of Spock's confusion and adding to it. "I was not certain that you would be aware of the fact," Spock replies, "but you are correct. I was unaware of your existence until 1 week ago." Storek nods, as if that is exactly what he was expecting. Spock only wishes that he could do the same. Expect the unexpected, indeed.
"It is my goal to be as light a burden as possible on you and on Captain Kirk,"
Storek announces.
"I assume that you have made, or will soon make, provisions for my education. I do not require anything else, with the exception of basic amenities such as food and clothing. As I hope you have already perceived, I do not require adult supervision, as I am sufficiently mature to supervise myself."
Spock is displeased to find himself once again thrown off balance by a 10-year-old. The past 12.4 minutes have seen an unacceptable number of instances of this phenomenon, and Spock is determined to end it. "As much as I respect your desire to be self-sufficient," Spock says, "it is the responsibility of your guardians to determine the level of supervision that you require. We will certainly consider your input when making our decisions." Storek meets Spock's pronouncement with the same level blankness that he has displayed towards everything else. He picks up his small piece of luggage, carries it into his bedroom, and begins unpacking his belongings. They appear to consist only of clothes. No one has had time to collect personal mementos during the evacuation of Vulcan. Spock is left somewhat at a loss for what to do with himself for the remaining 44.3 minutes until Captain Kirk can reasonably be expected to return. Storek appears to have the unpacking process fully in hand, and is ignoring Spock quite pointedly and successfully. "And what subjects will you require instruction?" Spock asks. This seems to him a reasonably neutral topic to broach. Without looking up from his unpacking, Storek rattles off,
"Philosophy and ethics, mathematics, physics, engineering, biology, chemistry, history, xenology, and languages. I am fluent in high and standard Vulcan and Federation standard."
Spock waits silently, but no further communication appears to be forthcoming. He departs Storek's room in search of a pad with which to access crew member files in order to determine who might be qualified to teach the subjects that Storek has identified. He cannot fully suppress the irrational feeling that his departure is motivated partially by an impulse tangentially related to cowardice. As he peruses the files, making special note of those crew members that have volunteered their teaching services to him or to the captain, Spock reminds himself that Storek is merely engaging in quite reasonable self-protective practices. The boy knows nothing of Spock's character or temperament, and it is only logical that he would seek to preserve a defensive distance until they have taken each other's measures. It is likely that their interactions will become more comfortable over time. By the time that Captain Kirk returns to begin Storek's tour, Spock has compiled a preliminary list of instructors. In the area of languages, there is no immediate apparent candidate for reasons that Spock prefers not to think about. But there is at least no shortage of possible instructors in physics.
"Hey, Spock!"
Kirk calls as he strolls into Spock's chambers.
"How's Storek? Everybody getting along all right?"
"Storek is well," Spock replies. I have been assigning volunteers from the crew to instruct him in their specialties. Perhaps later today you could examine the list and offer me your perspective.
Sounds like a blast.
Storick emerges from his room as Kirk asks,
So do you have me on that teaching roster somewhere?
I do not, Spock admits. It is not that the idea has not occurred to him, and it is not that Captain Kirk is not sufficiently intelligent to qualify, simply that, in any specialty that Kirk is familiar with, there is another crew member whose expertise far exceeds his own. Spock explains this, and Kirk scoffs.
I don't believe that. You are a human,
Storick says, and both Kirk and Spock turn to face him.
It is therefore unlikely that your grasp of any subject, given the relative limitations of the human brain and the inconsistency of Earth educational systems, would exceed my own greatly enough that you could ably instruct me.
Although it seems clear to Spock that Storick did not intend it as such, his statement is a serious insult, and Spock waits for Kirk to respond to it the way he responds to all insults. In Spock's experience, by laughing, or by lashing out. He is surprised when the captain does neither. Instead chooses to give Storick's contention serious consideration.
When it comes to subjects like math and science, you're probably right,
Kirk says, speaking directly to Storick and taking a seat that brings his eyes level with Storick's own.
Although, let me say in my own defense that the whole reason Spock and I met, back before the Narada incident, was that I had successfully hacked a very sophisticated computer program created by a Vulcan.
Storick appears to silently digest this.
But anyway, math and science isn't all there is to know,
Kirk says with a casual grin.
If you want to learn to speak the Delton language, I'm your man. I'm also a certified hand-to-hand combat instructor, but those are things you can learn from any species. If you want to know things that only a human can teach you, or that a human can teach best, I can do that. Spock will tell you. I'm the humanest human he's ever met. Right, Spock?
Spock intentionally ignores Kirk's comments, although in a strange way, he believes it to be unusually accurate. Storick does not even glance his way.
What are these skills that you believe that humans are best qualified to teach?
He asks Kirk, showing a spark of interest for the first time since he stepped off of the shuttle.
I can lie,
Kirk offers.
I'm good at it. And I can teach you how, if you want to learn. Most kids I've met, and most Vulcans, aren't very good at it. But it's a useful thing to know.
Storick frowns and says,
Lying is morally reprehensible.
Kirk just nods and agrees.
It is. And so is violence. But sometimes violence is necessary. And it's important to be prepared for that. Same goes for lying.
Storick looks to Spock, and Kirk does the same, his face betraying his curiosity about Spock's reaction. The captain is correct, Spock tells Storick, and Kirk grins and does a little bow, which Spock once again pointedly ignores. He continues, Deception, while distasteful, can sometimes save lives. It is a skill that many Vulcans, myself included, have cultivated, but Captain Kirk is my superior. In this particular field, he adds, staving off the obnoxious comment that Kirk would certainly have made under other circumstances, although he has so far shown a welcome sense of decorum in front of the child. Storick considers this for a moment, then turns to Kirk.
Your logic has merit,
he announces, before turning back to address Spock.
Please add a period of instruction in human skills by Captain Kirk to the syllabus that you are preparing. Awesome,
Kirk says, visibly enthused.
Do you want to take that tour of the Enterprise now, Storick? That would be acceptable. See you later, Spock,
Kirk calls, waving a hand as he and Storick depart Spock's quarters. Unobserved, Spock allows himself the indulgence of one very deep breath, and its accompanying sigh. It appears that parenting, at least in the short term, will be very much like everything else in Spock's life over the last 6 months. An occasion for suppressing equal amounts of exasperation and admiration at Captain Kirk's instinctive facility in areas where any reasonable being would expect Spock to surpass him.